Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
So, of course, I'm back with my old pal, Brian Rumley, but because Brian, we've done a ton of work together. You've been on the show now for a couple of years.
Thank you very much. Yes.
But this is the first time we've actually met in person.
Yes.
So it's a real delight to finally meet you in person.
It is an honor to meet you, sir.
So tell me, what have you enjoyed about Money 2020? Obviously, you're the voice first voice at Money 2020, but what's been really impactful for you?
You know, the first 2 days, it was AI.
Yeah.
They literally, all day Sunday, was an AI enterprise of trying to explore it with bankers. And it's interesting because they were sold out. I mean, you know, all of the different lectures, the standing room only on most of them. And I think that's a really positive thing for bankers who are trying to finally to catch up in it. So that was interesting. And of course, voice first to me is just the user interface to AI.
Right.
Right? Ultimately, you're going to be asking things and it'll get it done and the AI is doing all that powerful stuff.
So tell me, what's been really exciting for you at the show, though, in terms of the AI and voice first stuff?
Brett, I tell you, it's just a whole idea that this event is moved rapidly into AI. The very first 2 days, most of the lectures have been based around how AI is a real threat and an existential threat. It's also a buzzword, and it's on the buzz cycle. So some of it is just subterfuge, but some of it is real, and it's really... What Woz said in his speech on Sunday, he said it's really not artificial intelligence, it's simulated intelligence.
Right.
And that's the great way to look at it. And your view of augmented, right? And intelligence amplification. You were ahead of the curve on that. But the reality is it's really permeating every aspect of financial services and banking. And it's only going to get more complex if you're not ahead of it. And we're definitely seeing that trend. And voice is the user interface to it. That's how I see it.
So Woz had some controversial comments to make, didn't he? Particularly in terms of self-driving cars and so forth.
Yes, he did. He's an early Uber driver. And he started driving Ubers, I think, at car 4. And he tweets a lot about it. So we get to know where he's going, where the superchargers are. And it was the first time I heard
Tesla.
What am I saying? Uber driver. Yeah, Tesla. All along this Tesla use, we didn't really know how intense he was about some of the things about the guidance, self-driving. And he's come to the conclusion that self-driving cars are a lot further away on city streets, suburban streets, because there's too much randomness. And he said, this being behind the wheel, seeing how it reacts, it's not going to be that. He said, certainly said trucks in special lanes and highway usage, yes, but... not that. So he was kind of very hardcore about that.
Yeah.
And he talked Bitcoin too. And he said, Bitcoin is mathematical. I'm a mathematician.
He's a big fan of Bitcoin.
Very big. And I think it kind of took everybody by surprise. And he even talked about it. He lost on Mt. Gox. You know, he goes, I faxed him over a driver's license, a fax of my driver's license to buy Bitcoin. How strange that is. And he goes, I should have realized I would get taken advantage of.
Yeah.
But he, I guess, subsequently recovered from that and is a big supporter of Bitcoin.
So in terms of the demos you've seen around the voice first stuff or voice stuff, what have you found that's been of interest to you?
Of course, it's more of a banking financial services type of environment. And I've noticed a lot of people talking about it. Clink is doing some great work.
Yeah.
There's a couple of other startups that I saw. And they're all coming down to doing the low-hanging fruit. Well, how much is my balance? What did I pay?
Right.
The voice-first revolution that I see is more of a personal assistant that knows your context, knows what you can afford, knows what your goals and ambitions are, and we're not there yet. You know, we're in the text line before the graphic user interface came about era of voice-first. And once we get that high context, and we know what a user really wants from a financial services company, whatever that is in the future, a bank, whatever that is in the future, and you have a lot to say about that, and commerce, whatever that is in the future. So I think over time, these interactions will become so personal that you could not live without your personal assistant advising you in real time. And creating on-demand, real-time credit granting, which I think is the future in a post-Equifax world.
It's all about behavior.
Yeah, looking at your social signaling, looking at your previous transactions, the more you have access to that data, the more worrisome it becomes, but the more personal it becomes and the more powerful it is. So we ultimately, at some point, we'll talk about security of that data. And again, in the post-Equifax type of scenario, what does that look like when something knows everything you've ever wanted to buy, everything you are going to buy, all your goals and ambitions? It's interesting.
It's pretty personal.
It is about as personal as it gets.
But it's what makes you uniquely you. And so that's just a data profile of
precisely
you as a person. Yeah.
And that's going to become more and more powerful, more and more challenging for traditional legacy players. How do they fit into that? Because they literally have to rebuild themselves if they can do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that some can't. I think that, you know, the whole credit granting scenario is antiquated to time serving and time sharing computer systems. I mean, Equifax was built on time sharing systems. It doesn't even make any sense anymore.
No, it's become pretty clear that the data that we used to consider identity data, like your date of birth, address, mother's maiden name, your social security number, this data is just not securable anymore in a conventional sense.
I'd well assume
sense.
It doesn't exist anymore.
Right. So then you have to have a new paradigm. It can't be, it has to be, you know, what else uniquely identifies you. And
you pinned it in your books because it's context. It's all who you are.
Yeah.
And the person or the organization that understands that and grows around that, I think not only controls financial service, but controls retail.
Yeah.
Because I think those two things, and Jeff Bezos, we're in his rear mirror, right? Because he's out front ahead.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
in a rocket. We're in bicycles a lot of the rest of the world. And he's got 7,000 people working on Alexa. And you know, this deal that he did with Clover, it was announced with First Data and Clover, you can now order food inside the Amazon app.
But you can just say, I'm hungry, Alexa, right?
And it goes to a local restaurant
yeah,
and then somebody, maybe someday it drones out.
Yeah.
In that world, you can almost be disenchanted. How can I ever compete with Amazon? My thing is, there's a lot of ways to compete against that. Once that becomes a new standard, there's more than enough to go around it.
Plug into the service layer.
Yes.
You know, what's really interesting about this is people don't really understand the implications of the Whole Foods acquisition.
Oh,
people
boy.
Think it's about getting Amazon retail spaces. It's not. He's carving out these distribution zones from all of these Whole Foods locations to send stuff out via drone in the future. He thinks decades ahead.
You got to hand it to him. I mean, he's been so far ahead from one click. I mean, I remember when one click was patented.
Yeah.
And I remember when it was invented. And I'm like, yeah, it seems logical, but nobody did that really to the level that he did. And it was the fear of what if that one click sent something out that they didn't want. And he goes, that was an existential fear. And we resolved it 3 months into it and we figured it out.
Yeah.
And that same existential fear is where he always seems to operate. And I believe he's going to go down a banking type of relationship, whatever we define a banking relationship to be in the future. Amazon's got more data about us than Equifax ever did.
Yeah, absolutely.
And good, strong data.
Yeah, solid data. Yeah.
Yeah, because you know what
much
you
more
buy.
Predictive in terms of your behavioral patterns and so forth. So let me get a little bit personal for a minute.
Yes.
What do you do when you're not at conferences and events? What do you spend your time doing? You're obviously a champion for Voice First, but how do you make a living? And you know, do you spend a lot of time on the road? Where do you live?
Try not to be on
Tell
the road.
Tell me a bit more about Brian.
Well, thanks for asking. All right, so I've done very well in my life. So financially, I'm not seeking to necessarily have a job or whatever. Although I'd like to build things I want to build. So I decloaked my secret love of voice about 5 years ago. I've been more public about it. I've been in payments for over 37 years. So that, you know, that's kind of out there. And, you know, I was an ISO and that helped me learn how small merchants operate. And it really educated me. I got a PhD in small merchants. I call it a practical and pragmatic philosophy. And that is, we can have all the tech that we want. If it doesn't fit into their practical and pragmatic philosophy, they say, take this tech out of this business, right? So that kind of helps to some of my income still today. I'm a Bitcoin miner for many years, so that's definitely helping right now.
Good.
And I guess I don't have a card that says consultant, but I've done a lot of consulting and advising legacy companies, banks that have the existential and real threat, and startups. I've worked with a lot of startups, officially and unofficially, to try to usher in what the next fintech payment banking revolution might look like, with a lot of help from your reading and the books that you put out there. But Yeah, so most of my time is occupied in doing that. Plus, I'm a researcher. If you were to say, what would you rather
do? That's clear, yeah.
I'd rather just be building stuff in a lab and hopefully seeing it in the real world. So that's my dream. My dream is to start taking some of the dialogue voice-first systems that I already have and bring them into the real world, and whether that means that's in a legacy company or as a startup, I'm still making that decision, folks. I don't know, but I want to do it.
And I have to assume from your social media profile that you're a bit of a musician as well.
Yeah, I started out, I was a very shy guy. I thought I was going to be a physicist when I was younger around Princeton. I didn't officially go to Princeton, but I really thought I was going to do that. But the music drew me out, and I played guitar, and I sung a little bit, keyboards, and later on. And throughout my life, I've advised people, and that's one of the reasons I'm in Southern California. I've advised people in the musical space and acting and all that kind of stuff. And I never really drift far from it because it keeps me grounded in what I sense, a sense of reality. Otherwise, I get way too esoteric with the technology.
Yeah.
And I want to try to say it's about people too, and music lyrics, and that kind of grounds me into that. So
being a Bitcoin miner and sort of understanding a little bit about the blockchain, how do you think that might affect the music industry?
Radically. I really think that blockchain is good. And I hate saying it because it now sounds very knee-jerk reactionary,
right?
Everything would be blockchain. But it really is. And what is blockchain really? It's a database. It's a ledger.
Right.
It's public, right? It's not magical. Neither is AI, right?
It's
But AI, blockchain, and quantum. You can get me talking about quantum computing. I've been spending a lot of, if you ask what a lot of the things I've spent my coding time on is building quantum algorithms. I have a little bit of access to a quantum computer, and my physics background is finally materializing in the real world. We literally are working on metaverses when we're solving these problems. We're literally going, at least in the current paradigm, into another universe that doesn't exist where we are to go and have that problem solved and come back and deliver the answer.
Amazing.
So we're living in that space. It's happening right now, and the compression. I mean, we're old enough to, you know, I'm a lot older, but you know, we're old enough to remember when we could sit back 3 to 5 years. You kind of see the arc. Now it's compressed into 7, 8, 10 months. And Moore's law in quantum computing, I think, is what the equivalent will be, is going to be more fascinating because it's not linear. And it's not even exponential. It's a
And you've got to come up with new programming paradigms to build.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and you know, Walt Mossberg recently retired, and one of the things Walt said is one of the things that sort of dismayed him on the later arc of his career was the devices started to disappear. The things that really drove him, that he was such a great guy reviewing things, and those devices are disappearing, and they're flattening out into almost nothing. And part of the voice-first revolution I talk about, it's not so much the voice. The voice is just the cover for the AI that we're interacting with.
Yeah.
And we're using our best thing that the Broca area in our brain gave us to communicate to that. And the AI is doing all the lever or heavy lifting.
So eliminating all of that input-output friction that we used to have with old computing platforms, it's just become embedded into our world.
Yeah.
Just and this underlying intelligence.
And it's so fast that we're like, hold it, I want to give up my thumbs. But that was a sidetrack because a computer couldn't understand your intent.
Yeah.
And now that we can understand your intent, we now have a real tool. All we are as humans are tool builders. It's all we've ever done.
And then it's just about visualization of the data, and smart glasses will be the next piece to that, right?
I happen to think that we're going to be projecting holographic in front of us darn quicker. But smart glasses are the beginnings
the
to that.
The gateway to that. Yeah,
and when we get into holographic 3D in front of us, which is not, there's a stealth startup I can talk about that is visualizing with laser data and objects and things right in front of you. Once you live in that space, then what AR, MR, and VR was is something entirely. And of course, you're talking to it, interacting it, and it's morphing into whatever you want it to be. And then that's what I call the last interface. The last interface is our voice and that. And I don't believe in the neuronal connection that you're going to plug into your brain, because I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to be where we're just all one hive
mind. But you can still augment your intelligence in a passive way with these technologies.
So. Yeah, you know, I think we're all going to be facing what is humanity in our lifetimes. We're going to have to really look at that, because everybody's job is going to be impacted by robotics and AI.
Absolutely.
I don't think anybody... any profession is safe, and the only thing that you can do is your creativity. I don't think we can simulate human creativity, and I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, right? I think it's a good thing for humans, and I'm not thinking...
We don't necessarily want to teach robots how we treat, how we deal with ethics, right? We want the best of us.
No, if we do that, then we do have a quagmire ahead.
All right, well, I have officially geeked out for the Money 2020. It's the geekiest interview I've done.
Thank you very much.
That makes a lot of sense, the way we talk
together. I am the super geek.
Absolutely, but it's been absolute pleasure, wow. Brian. And
pleasure.
Safe travels, sir. And we'll see you again on the show soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're here with Boxley and Rob at the Provoke Breaking Banks media pod, talking about you guys have announced a cooperation here at Money 2020. So tell us a bit about first of all, tell us about Segment and tell us about the data insights, customer insights practice at IBM and how you guys are working together. Do you want to kick us off, Rob?
Sure. Thank you. I was going to your mic, but I have one.
Yeah, you got your own mic, sir.
So I wanted to talk a little bit. What we're really good at is transaction identification, categorization. Probably the global leader in that. And what we do is we process transactions extremely fast from lots of institutions to categorize it in a way that they can use it for other things, right? And we have an end-to-end marketing platform that we do, and we partner with several other companies. And one of the things that's important about what we're doing with IBM is all the insights of all those transactions are really important to really understand the customer and deliver great value. It could be personalization, it could be onboarding, right? Cross-selling, right? Anything to really help the journey of that customer and do some responsible marketing, as we call it. Together, we can work together to help deliver those insights right to a relationship manager.
So in terms of the insights part of this, Boxley, where does the predictive and the analytics come into this that you guys are developing on your platforms?
Well, much like Rob, we recognize that you can do a lot more now. Technology allows you to do a lot deeper analytics, use more data, use external data as well as the data that financial institutions have. And many of the models across wealth management, insurance, retail banking, even commercial banking. So we took a broad view that says, let's go do some of these analytics, let's do predictions, let's do better segmentation, and come back with clients that could really be more innovative and, importantly, be better for their customers.
So, Rob, in the UK, we're seeing a big push to open banking, PSD2 and so forth. We see the Hong Kong market has just come out with a regulatory framework that's going to mimic what's happening in the UK. So clearly there's a push towards, or there is a future where there's an expectation this data is supposed to be real time. But in the United States, we're well behind China and the EU in respect to this real-time payments architecture.
Yeah.
So, what are you guys doing to bridge that gap between data that's sort of delayed that you can segment from banks through aggregation versus real-time processing of that data?
So we're really built from the ground up as real-time. Where we're handcuffed is typically the core of the payments provider that's sending us the data. We'll take it as fast as they will send it to us, but they're still reinventing and re-architecting to get real-time.
Right.
So especially in the U.S., we see a lot of, there's not that many real-time cores, but the need of real-time data is critical in terms of sense and response of what a customer needs in the moment, right? And especially as you get to cognitive and conversation.
Of course. Yeah. So do you feel like that capability, essentially that middleware layer of being able to pull that data out, is that sort of where your platform might evolve?
Oh, absolutely. I think where we're sitting is we think it will be right on the stream of most of the transactions that are happening, not just here, but around the world. And that's important in terms of building the next level of applications. If you look at what we're doing, we're like the building blocks of creating that real-time, fast understanding what the customer needs based on maybe a transaction that happened, or maybe they walked into a branch and used what we call intent KLIs to do that. All of that, we do a lot of real-time right now just based on customer service and visiting websites and journeys and stuff like that, but it's the transactions that really need to go to the next level.
So could you circumvent the processes to some extent, go directly to the card at the auth level, or?
I can't say that because we like to partner with certain people.
Okay, fair enough. But definitely you're of the school of thought that we need to move to a real-time world in terms of this data.
It's critical, absolutely critical, yeah.
So how do you think we get the U.S. to get their head around this problem?
We get the banks to partner with IBM.
Yeah?
Yeah. No, I think it's... There's a big transformation that has to happen, right? And I think that's what they're trying to all figure that out now. And I think they've made a great leap in terms of transforming the experience and making it digital, but now they have to go kind of that next level, which is, you know, make it do something, make it personalized, make it make it real time so that they can actually have a real time conversation.
Yeah. And so give me some scenarios of where you think in the future this sort of real time customer insights could be actually reflected in terms of a day-to-day banking experience or money experience.
There's several types of tremors you feel before the earthquake of a customer event. So if you're able to predict in time, you can make a big difference. And some of those are very real time.
Yeah.
Customer service would fall into that category. There are others like predicting retirement, where you've got a little bit of time, but you're starting to pick up clues that say, this person's starting to spend different or behave different or shop in different places or look at different places
on
the website.
You know, so we saw a firm launch their real-time credit offering, in-store financing. Do you see that that's a possibility, real-time credit provisioning in-store?
If the government will allow. Regulatory controls will still keep us being very honest and direct, and in some cases we'll have to go through processes.
That would simply mean that the U.S. slips further behind other markets that can already do that. So, if New York wants to remain a international financial center, that's not really an excuse anymore, is it?
I think we can do both, because the ability to understand regulation and be able to be compliant with it is starting to move at the speed of light now. And that makes a big difference.
Let's take the customer insights piece of this, because this is really what interests me. Yeah. If you can apply this data and you've got the right data, then there's no reason why you can't make a credit decisioning at lower risk than we do today with credit scores for a customer in real time. Am I correct?
I think it maybe even goes beyond that. I think it's.
Yeah.
I think you can make both decisioning of the credit, but I think you can also say, well, I also want to be the first money out after a paycheck,
right?
There's something
so
that has to happen.
So you can reduce risk in terms of default and so
exactly
forth.
Exactly right.
Right. So then
a lot of it's about friction too, and what you're really talking about is let's take all the friction of the paperwork and the processes out and just get down to what's required to be legal and meet the risk requirements of the bank and provide the service.
Well, you know, it's really interesting to see, even just with the fintechs playing in this space. I saw some TransUnion research data that came out about a month ago, and they've shown that between 2012 and 2016, in the unsecured personal lending space in the US, fintechs have gone from a 3% market share to 30% market share, but their recovery costs on bad debts is about 20% of what traditional lenders are paying in this space. That's a pretty significant data point. It's a big shift. But if you look at LendingClub, one of their key insights into this was, I thought, brilliant. We've had them on the show previously. They said just knowing one data point reduced their default risk significantly. That was whether someone pays their phone bill on time.
Wow.
Default risk than a credit score.
We behave in public with all of these things, paying bills, providing information, searching your website, and those behaviors are very, we just over and over have taken that behavioral data, both of us together and in different corners, said, hey, we can predict a person's actions very
So tell me how a typical implementation with you guys would go, working with a bank, trying to build in this capability. How do you guys work together on a project like that?
Well, we can talk a little bit about it. I think they have a great product. We haven't seen it as customer insights for banking, but there's a lot that goes into both servicing the customer, right? One of those is maturity of the product, right? How much are they using the product, but how much have they done to like actually onboard themselves, right?
Right.
And that is, if you look at a simple credit card, right? They've applied it, they've activated it, they haven't used it, right? Or they use it very little. And I think it's both, not just are using it for certain categories, but the banks have so much information around this data. I talk a lot about, sometimes it's not just the data, but the absence of the data, the absence of the spend, right? Where we're seeing a lot of bill pay going out to another credit card company, but zero transactions around travel or meals. So they're spending it on something else to get better rewards, right? So it's all about the messaging and how you like work to really know the customer is what's so critical about, you know, creating a great long-term relationship. And that's really what this partnership is doing. If you look at what they're doing from the Watson and start to, you know, really understand the propensity of what the customer is going to do, and then start to see that some of the lifestyle changes that we're driving right into the campaign of both onboarding the product, but what is it they like about these other products they're using with another bank, right? That goes a long way to start to change the messaging and the approach of how you go after a customer.
And specifically to your question, how do you put it together is data, is getting the models right, and then there's providing the insight in a way it's useful. Yes. So data collection can be what you've already got, maybe what else we could go get, and as specific to customers as we have. Once we got that, we pick models and lifestyle indicators and all sorts of information that maybe goes together. Maybe it's one big model, or maybe it's a lot of little models. Maybe it's some cool Watson stuff you go add to it for personality or information that can then hit the third spot, which is, okay, I've got an insight. I've got a customer with a credit score, to your example earlier, or I've got a customer with a propensity to buy or to attrit. And that information
goes forward. So let's drill down on that a little bit, you know, because voice has been a big topic of conversation at Money 2020 this year round. And, you know, so, you know, let's give you a couple of simple scenarios. You know, if you know, because this is insights, you know, if I want to ask in the future some technology layer, whether it's Siri or Bixby or a Watson-led interface, and I want to ask a simple question, like, can I afford to go out for dinner? Can I afford to buy this flat screen TV? These are pretty valuable insights day to day that, you know, we should be able to surface as a bank that has, you know, a basic modicum of data on you. So how soon do you see us being able to surface that type of relationship based on customer data?
I think it all starts with kind of those building blocks. Like, that's what I was talking about earlier. I think the data, and if you look at what we're doing from a finite perspective around KLIs, it's there.
So what's a KLI?
It's called Key Lifestyle Indicator.
Okay.
It's metadata that comes from the transactions. That's what we're working with IBM on. That's our product. And if you really look at what that does from an execution perspective, you just said, can I afford dinner?
Yeah.
Well, the question shouldn't be a yes or a no. It is, well, what kind of dinner?
Right.
It shouldn't just be, you know, yes, you can afford a dinner, but you're probably going to fast food or fast casual, right? Not fine dining.
Yeah. So that's something that you think is in the realm of possibilities in terms of data?
Yeah, I think we're here. It's just about building out the applications to do that.
And maybe more valuable to you before you decided to go out for dinner, if you've gotten a message that said, hey, looking at your cash flow 3 weeks from now or 3 days from now, we're projecting you to be at zero. You might want to think about your spending rates for the next few days. So actually getting proactive with some of those conversations would be very valuable.
Well, that would be a lot stickier than saying, I've got a branch around the corner you can visit, right? Be a lot more productive, right?
Yeah. So I think there's a big essence of just understanding, you know, there's a lot about financial wellness here, right? But just understanding simple budgeting, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of education that has to happen in this marketplace to the consumer that stopped happening when the breakdown of, you know, bankers and branches and now they're just, it's all search-based, right?
Yeah, there's a fair bit of evidence to suggest that financial education and literacy is actually going backwards right now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So the technology needs to fill the gap, yeah?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Very good. So what else do you guys got to tell us about before we finish up today? How do we find out about what you're doing and the tools and...
Well, we're easy, segment.com, S-E-G-M-I-N-T.
So yep, Mint, Segment.
We did release a product here at Money 2020 called the KLI Insights platform, right?
Cool.
So it allows, you know, developers and stuff to build out applications a lot like we're talking about from a voice perspective, especially how we work with IBM in terms of inputs into Watson and how we can do a lot in the future.
And we're pretty easy to find in the phone book too.
But
more importantly, I think the you know, the fact that we're broadening this from simple analytics tools to things that really make a difference to customers' lives, and that difference is significant. And part of it's because we can, and part of it because financial institutions need it pretty badly.
Well, and we should, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we have a responsibility to help, right, the customer, and really understand, and do it in a way that's responsible.
Great. Well, Rob, Bobsley, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks and ProAct today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Fantastic.
it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Okay, so Dana, welcome to the Breaking Banks Provoke podcast. In Money 2020. Now, you guys, tell me about GeoSwift and what you guys are doing. You know, you're obviously bridging sort of two different worlds, but give us a little bit more detail for people that don't know you guys.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us here. We appreciate it. So we do a lot of, our sort of primary focus is payments into and out of China. We do disbursements to recipients in China, so it typically falls in with clients that need to move thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of payments to recipients in China, and they're looking for a compliant, streamlined way to do that. And you probably know the China regulatory environment is very complex, not easy to navigate, very different from everywhere else in the world. Our differentiator in that market really is around our connections in China. We're connected directly to 16 different PSPs for redundancy purposes.
And what's a PSP?
Payment service providers in China. They're the ones that are licensed within China to do the disbursement directly on the rails there. They're kind of like ACH rails. It's called CNAPs. And we're connected to 16 of those, so that's really a differentiator. You need backup in China. If something happens to one from a regulatory perspective, you really need a secondary channel or a third channel.
And then we also, regulatory changes can happen quite radically and quickly in China.
Radically and quickly, and with very little, if no notice. And also, I think a lot of the payment service providers in China just face regular scrutiny and audits, and we do a lot of that monitoring of those. We do regular checks of our partners, making sure that all of the information security is buttoned up and their compliance processes are very tightly monitored. And then on the other side of the payments, we also do payments out of China. So we are connected, we have a payment gateway, and we're connected with UnionPay, Alipay, TenPay, all of the relevant payment types for China, recently licensed with WeChat as well. And in some circumstances, we also can do bank transfer payments, like for tuition. We do a big piece of our business is around tuition payments. So parent in China that students studying at Harvard, we can collect those payments from China and settle them.
So both ways, in and out
correct.
Of China.
Absolutely,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, tell me, you know, the China mobile landscape, payments landscape is incredible. We've seen both Alipay and WeChat, you know, Tencent, talking about it here. $5.5 trillion in mobile payments, 92% of that going across these two technology networks, as opposed to through traditional ACH and or card rails.
Yeah.
How is that changing the way people think about money movement in China, and how's that impacted your business?
I think in China especially, there's a lot of need for lower value payments, whether it's in mobile or even in traditional payouts or online collecting payments. A lot of it is more like under $100, where typically would have been banks that support wires going to China or out of China. Wires aren't necessarily the most efficient anymore because of the low value nature of payments. The wire fees are expensive, so the banks they're not always the best player for that market. And sort of alternative methods to either making or receiving money outside of a wire, which is sort of the old school way to pass money, and we see that with WeChat Pay and a lot of those. Even in addition to mobile, there's also WeChat Pay online.
Right.
It's very popular. It's QR code based.
Yeah.
So we support all of those.
You support all
members.
That.
Yeah.
So do you see evidence of people doing cross-border stuff, like in family situations, like we see with Venmo in the U.S.? Do you see that now working with Chinese immigrants and so forth?
Yeah, it's a great point. We actually, for the past 2 years, one of our most key product requests from the U.S. and Europe was remittance service into China.
Right.
It just didn't really exist. And we've spent the last 18 months developing a new person-to-person remittance solution with Bank of Shanghai that we actually just announced yesterday here at Money 2020. And it basically will allow companies, whether it's a financial company in the U.S. that services that Venmo type of model, person-to-person, to connect with us, and we're connected directly with Bank of Shanghai to do a person-to-person remittance. And that is a huge demand that we've seen for the past 2 years. It's just very difficult in China because of the compliance rules around the remittances. So we took a lot of time figuring out what a very compliant solution. We'll actually have more than one solution starting in Q1.
So China's been talking about the fact that in these urban centers where, you know, you've got these mobile payments taking off, that they're soon going to be cashless in many of these urban centers. That's tending towards that. But I'm interested in, as we shift more and more digital payments, and obviously this is happening faster in China than it is in the US, and we've got these new players coming into that. Obviously you have to cash in to Tencent or WeChat or Alipay from an existing bank. But those funds, once they go into those networks, are they coming back out, or are those networks just tending to grow in size?
That's a good point. I think that the consumer, like in China, has options. So a lot of them can leave their, similar to PayPal, where you could have a PayPal balance that you could leave in there and use it to pay for other things. It's very similar with like an Alipay account, where it's a wallet account.
Well, they've
you can
done
keep the money in.
Weibao as well, the savings money market fund off that as well. So.
And there is, so there is a lot of that. I think that they use that to pay out and make purchases online for other things without ever sometimes actually cashing
it out
completely.
Out, yeah.
Which then lends towards more cashless, movement of money.
Which it lends to you more support for your platforms.
Yeah, it really does. And it sort of moves to the whole, I guess if you talk about disruptors, it's really a banking disruptor in that they rely less and less on the banks.
Yes.
And they keep everything sort of within these e-wallets or their mobile. You know, as you probably know, WeChat is just enormously popular in China, and a lot of people choose to move their money, whether it's person to person or making purchases within their WeChat app, and it's growing outside of China as well. I know a lot of our employees, when they travel, they use that at the point of sale. They'll pay with their WeChat mobile device, and that's really probably the biggest consumer trend that we've seen over the past 18 months.
How much time do you spend in China?
At least once or twice a quarter. So we have an office in Hong Kong is our headquarters, but we have a large office in Shanghai.
Yep.
So I'm there quite a bit. So it's always exciting to see the way they do things. It's kind of a great feet on the ground experience to see how they pay. And a lot of times, as you probably know, traditional payment methods like Visa, MasterCard are not prevalent there. So sometimes I go to Shanghai, I literally cannot go to a restaurant and buy a sandwich. They take Union Pay only, usually, in the store in WeChat. So it's like, it really makes you think you've got to like update the way you pay when you travel, because so many times we're just not equipped to make a payment when you go to one of these countries. problem.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So tell me about what you guys are announcing at Money 2020 or what you're doing here.
So probably our key announcement is our person-to-person remittance product that we're doing with Bank of Shanghai. We're here meeting with a lot of great partners just on their strategy towards China, and it's, I think what I said, it's like so unique there that there's really so many different, especially compliance and info security. I feel like that's really our differentiator, because we sort of try to map to a U.S. mentality, sometimes banking standards in terms of compliance and transparency, information security. We've spent 2 years really building out our entire infrastructure around that to accommodate the needs and the requirements of very scrutinous U.S. compliance departments, so that we could win some huge RFPs, which we've done in the past couple years. And I think that's lent itself to a lot of people feeling more confident going into China, where they felt very nervous in the past. Yeah. A lot of times they try to go to direct to a Chinese company, and they feel like they don't get the transparency they need going direct, so they need an intermediary to sort of bridge that gap.
Now, it is a bit ironic, isn't it, that China seems to have leapfrogged the U.S. when it comes to mobile payments. We always thought of the U.S. as being the world leader in banking, but really, China's put us to shame on mobile payments. How do we bridge the gap?
They really feel like we're sort of the antiquated way of doing things.
Did you see the Singaporean Prime Minister talking about mobile payments?
No, I didn't see it.
You should see his national address he did. I think it's back in August or September. But he gave this address and he said, Chinese tourists come to Singapore and they can't, quote, work out why we still have to pay with cash in stores, you know. They just find that mind-blowing.
Oh, yeah,
it's been such a behavioral shift in China so quickly.
Oh, absolutely.
And then you say, yeah, well, get them to the U.S. where they still write checks. It's crazy.
Oh, that's
right?
Crazy. And we also see, I was just talking to someone this morning at breakfast, so they're saying that their parent who leaves China to travel, a lot of times Chinese are sort of notorious for carrying cash everywhere they go, even with all the older generation in China. So a lot of times they'll come with cash to the hotel outside of China, thinking they can pay with cash. And so they have the same problem when they come out. They have to make sure that the hotel they're going to generally will only take Visa, MasterCard, and they may only have a UnionPay card or cash to pay. So the adoption from U.S. and European outlets like hotels and everything really have to adopt to the Chinese payment methods as well.
And obviously with the Chinese buying power and this global tourist business that's being built around this, we need to start thinking more globally about payments acceptance, right?
Absolutely. And even things like travelers coming out of Asia that need prepaid cards, or they want to be able to shop, they want a MasterCard or a Visa when they come to travel. We have a lot of solutions around that as well.
Cool.
We also have foreign exchange locations in mainland China. We service like all of the main airports. We have actual retail FX locations where you can get currency as you travel out. So that's a big part of our business, so we can help online travel agencies as clients travel, they book, and they want to book their FX as they leave. We can assist with that. That's also important. A lot of times they feel lost when they leave and they don't know, how the conversion rates should work and things like that. So there's a lot.
Very interesting.
Travel's huge right now.
Well,
100 million Chinese travel last year.
You've seen announcements recently about Alipay tying up with Coin, with Uber, with Marriott hotels and stuff.
Yeah.
So these guys are getting really aggressive about this. What do you think is going to happen with this MoneyGram acquisition happening in the U.S. with Alipay?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen, as you mentioned, there is a lot of sort of movement going into the U.S. from the Chinese companies acquiring U.S. clients.
Yeah.
And it is really aggressive, especially I've noticed.
And it's a new thing for China, because they tended to be quite insular, but now they're aggressively reaching out.
Absolutely.
And global reach.
So it used to be, I first started 3 years ago with GeoSwift. It was, we'd see a couple kind of making ways into the U.S. Now, if you see here at the show, there's 15 different China payment companies, PSPs, I'll call them. So there is a definitely aggressive move towards the U.S. acquisition. Just seeing the momentum, with the clients.
So China is on the move, the big dragon. So tell me, how do we find out more about what's happening at GeoSwift and up with you guys?
We're actually here at booth 1634, and you can stop by our website, our office.
What's the website?
www.geoswift.com.
Okay, great.
And we have our U.S. location. We're just outside of San Francisco, and we also have an office in London and Vancouver.
And in Hong Kong.
And Hong Kong is our headquarters, and Shanghai right. is a large presence for us as well for our operations.
Very cool. Yes. 你想到普通话?
No.
No. Okay. I lived in Hong Kong for 7 years.
Oh, did you really?
I just tested.
Oh, that was pretty good. That was pretty good.
All right, well,
good.
Listen, Dana, thanks for joining us.
Yes,
thanks for
thank
giving
you.
Us an update.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate
it. It's really exciting what's happening in China, and it's good to see that we're studying things systemically about bridging the two ecosystems, and I think that's really important.
Absolutely.
So thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Market to watch, for sure.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So I'm here with Andrew Morris, who's the Chief Content Officer, of course, of the organization that puts Money 2020 together. So, Andrew, this is the fifth year for Money 2020?
This is the sixth year in the U.S.
Sixth year in the U.S.
Absolutely, and I have attended all of them.
So, and how does that feel?
Yeah, it feels great, actually.
It feels great. You've got to say that, though.
But well, we're in the middle of a show, so...
It's all come together, and there's a lot of... There's certainly a lot of activity.
Right.
As the Chief Content Officer, though, you've really worked hard to craft something different this
sure.
year. There's been
right.
some phenomenal speakers.
Sure.
For you, what's been the highlight?
Well, there are a lot of highlights. We started with a bang. We had a special event this year called AI Deep Dive. It was
standing room only.
It was absolutely standing room only. It was actually three standing room only because we had one room and then others with live streaming because of the demand for the event. So Steve Wozniak was here, Michio.
He went a bit rogue, didn't he?
He went a little rogue, but what's exciting about Woz is that he's free to say what he thinks.
He's a free agent.
And it makes it exciting.
He doesn't
work for Apple anymore. Talked about having more than just Apple phones. And so that was exciting, and how he likes to experiment and he'd rather not read about it. He'd rather actually experience it and make his own judgment. So that was great.
And Dr. Kaku was here. I was just with him in speaking in Russia, actually.
Yes.
So he was on the stage.
It was
there.
Excellent. And Ray Kurzweil, we had via video conference. That was exciting to have that
did
all
he,
come
did
together.
Did he do the robot video conference? He sometimes does that with the roving robot.
It wasn't the roving robot. So obviously, so AI Deep Dive was a highlight. From there, we had some great keynotes on the next day. We're very excited about how the tracks have lined up. One of the things we've done this year is to have variety in the both the content and the format. So you go to conferences and it's sort of panel after panel and people are the same format. So we get feedback from attendees that says we want more depth. And one of the ways to get more depth is to have fewer people on panels, to have people who can present so they can develop a thought. And so I'm excited about the way those formats have played out. And
the Samsung live demo was pretty gutsy yesterday.
Well, see, that's exciting. Do people appreciate it when someone has the courage to go for doing a live demo on stage?
Yeah. So in terms of the growth of the event this year, how does it compare with previous years?
Well, one of the things that I'm excited about, I'm the director of content, so I look at how engaged our attendees are in our content and how full the rooms are, and I can tell you the excitement this year looks as well as it's ever been. So,
because the temptation at events like this is to be very focused on networking.
Absolutely.
But of course, the content really has differentiated this.
Well, there's different activities at a conference like this. So there are people that are engaged in the content. They tell us they want to learn, and we provide that. They are meeting with each other. And then there's maybe another third of them that are involved in our exhibitors and our exhibit hall experience. So at any given time, you can see people doing one of those three things as they're making their way through. Yeah.
Now, U.S., of course, is your primary event, but you now have events in other regions. So
absolutely.
Tell me about the plans for the next 12 months.
Well, absolutely. So now we're in a calendar where you can't rest all year or have a natural cycle all year. We're busy with Money 2020 all year long. So the USA event in October. The next event will be in March in Singapore, Money 2020 Asia. Then Money 2020 Europe, which this year will be in Amsterdam in June. And then we've announced, and then we'll roll around to the 2018 edition of USA,
yep.
and just announced at this conference, mainland China in Hangzhou.
Wow.
So November of 2018.
Very cool.
So four global events.
That's going to be pretty tough doing US and China back to back like that next year.
Well, the way our content team is organized is that we have local teams that focus on different events. So my focus is the US, and there are others that will focus on those local events.
Right.
And then we collaborate throughout the year to think about, you know, how we can learn and benefit and make all the events great.
So let's look under the hood a bit. Tell me about your team and tell me when you start planning for the event and, you know, how long it takes you to put the content together.
So the event ends on Wednesday. We'll start on Thursday.
Yeah.
We might take a little bit of a break. No. So for me, it is a bit of an annual cycle. Right? So our event's in October. So November and December is a chance to reflect, analyze. What could be better? You know what? And we talk to our customers through surveys and through interactions that we have on the phone. And so getting feedback about what went well. Then I spend a lot of time reaching out to the industry in the first half of the year. I go to other industry events. I talk to people on the phone. I've come from the payments industry, from the financial services industry. I was a consultant prior for many years. I actually joined Money 2020 because I was a speaker at Money 2020 and met the founders and joined the company. So I interact with the industry. And the first half of the year is a combination of that to figure out what are the themes and where we should go. Beginning to confirm speakers and build the momentum there. We had over 450 speakers at our event this year. And some of those get confirmed early, some of them get confirmed along the way.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you guys keep in touch with what's happening in the industry so that you can keep up with it?
Well, so one of the ways we do it is we talk to people like you, right? So one of the things I thought would be fun is you know, one of the highlights of yesterday's event was a debate that you had with Steve Ellis.
I think it went pretty well.
It was very fun. And when you were debating the future of banking.
Yep.
So I would be... So one of the things that would help me as the content director for Money 2020 is to understand if we could have another debate next year, what should we debate? Any thoughts on things that are exciting?
Yeah, I think the obvious one, based on the success you have here, is with AI developing, where do humans fit in the world? You know,
absolutely.
And I think that'd be a pretty strong debate. I think there's going to be people on both sides that argue and have strong opinions.
So right now, as we sit here in these chairs, in our lending track, there's a debate about the role of AI in credit decision.
Yeah.
So it's specific to credit. So, you know, you talk about AI, it's customer experience.
Maybe you could do something more on the role of advice itself.
The role of advice.
Yeah.
So the way that we understand what's happening in the industry is, you know, attending industry events, talking to our customers, talking to people that are in the industry.
I'll send you a copy of Bank 4.0.
Listening to Breaking Banks podcast, you know, those types of things is what we do. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think I learn from the doing the show.
Right.
I learn from interviewing people.
Right.
Even this time around, having a couple of people come in that have been speakers and hear about some of their updates. It's a continual learning process. The industry is moving very fast. So.
Well, Brett, it's interesting. You know, at one point at our event, we put together an advisory board, which was very helpful to have people in different roles. Then I begin to realize that I have hundreds of conversations a year. And every one of those conversations makes me a little bit smarter about what we should do with the event. So the advisory board is broader than that. So we stopped having a 10-person advisory board because I felt like I had hundreds of people. And we'll just listen and learn. Yeah.
So what makes Vegas the right location for Money 2020?
Well, it's great from a venue perspective. It's good for Silicon Valley. We have a lot of people come from California. It's a short trip for them.
Which is quite a differentiator in the fintech conference scene as well.
Well, it is, right? And I can remember the very first Money 2020 when I came as an attendee. And I was used to conferences where you would see, you know, payment processors and banks and people in financial services. But there was Google and Facebook and Twitter.
Yep.
And there were the venture community and startups. And that has continued to be the case. It's become a part of what this conference is about, that we bring these ecosystems together.
I did see an interesting tweet the other day, so I'll get your feedback on it. And the tweet was, in the early days of Money 2020, it was all the fintech guys, the tech guys, the geeks, right?
Right.
And banks weren't really engaged. And now the tweet was, banks are now sending armies of people to Money 2020 to learn. So do you think that reflects in terms of the makeup of attendees of the event?
I think it might. I think it also might be the evolution of how where banks are and they're thinking about innovation. And maybe Money 2020 and other events like ours played a role in that. They're realizing that to be competitive, that there are disruptors out there and that they need to either partner or innovate internally. And there's an awareness.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So for you personally, I know it's been a pretty brutal week for you, but what are you looking forward to doing the day after
Money 2020? Oh my goodness. Well, I give myself one day in Vegas to enjoy actually being here and maybe having a nice meal and going to the pool. And I enjoy, I look forward to hearing the feedback and kind of crunching all the numbers to see what happened. You can't be in every session all day long. So I'll actually spend a lot of time watching some videos and catching the highlights that I couldn't do as I was running the event.
Yeah. Now, at its peak, just on that, how many sessions are running simultaneously?
So we the most tracks that we're running was on Monday. So there were four tracks, one on payments, one on banking, one on security and identity, another on commerce and retail, and then we had our startup pitch event. So about five things happening at once. But we sometimes have some smaller venues, but generally they're big rooms. It's a big conference, but maybe four or five tracks.
Now, just maybe some other stuff. How do you guys continue to sort of facilitate networking at the event?
Well, so one of the things that we've done is the Brain Date program. So it's a curated networking so that you can go to our mobile app and you can help find people with common interests and use that. So that's very important. As we've grown as an event, you go from 2,000 to a much larger event. There's a need to curate that networking, and so we've done that. And you think about how you plan the venue and how you plan the spaces to make that happen.
Yeah. No, it's certainly an impressive event, and we thank you for giving us an update on Money 2020 this year, and look forward to your continued success.
Great. Well,
thanks for having us on the media team with Breaking Banks as well.
Well, great. Well, I guess we'll see you in Singapore.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I don't want to give you a call, dude, but thank you very much.
Okay.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.